The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. Hello everyone, welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine, and this week we're going to be continuing from what we did a couple of weeks ago, which was introducing great moments in world history. I enjoyed it so much I thought I'd do another one. So I've got five clips from previous episodes that highlight some of the most important events in world history. So continuing on from last time, so just to give you a bit of a taste, last time we spoke about how the dinosaurs were wiped out by an asteroid, when the Great Pyramid in Egypt was completed, when Sargon of Akkad created the world's first empire, we talked about Hammurabi's law code, and the volcanic explosion of Thera, which potentially weakened the Minoans into their ultimate demise. So we've got five more events to bring to you today. And our first one takes us back again to ancient Egypt when Amenhotep founded the city of Amarna. Now, Amenhotep the fourth, also known as Akhenaten, founded the city of Amarna, which is also called Akhetaten, during his reign as the pharaoh of ancient Egypt. Amenhotep the fourth established the city of Amarna as the new capital of Egypt. The city was located on the east bank of the River Nile, around 200 miles south of modern Cairo. Amarna was dedicated to the worship of the Aten, the sun disk, as the sole god. Amenhotep IV's establishment of Amarna marked a unique period in ancient Egyptian history, characterized by religious innovation and artistic expression. So Egypt would be at its most powerful extent for some time after Thutmose III's lifetime and right up into the 14th century BCE. Various pharaohs ruled Egypt and maintained its great extent. Thutmose III's bloodline would continue the dynasty until his great-grandson Amenhotep III became the pharaoh in the early 14th century BCE. This was a great cultural period of the New Kingdom. Amenhotep III would have a son who would succeed him as the pharaoh of Egypt, and he would come to reign as Amenhotep IV. Amenhotep IV is an incredibly unique and important individual when it comes to discussing the course of events of the New Kingdom. Now, traditionally, the Theban dynasties of the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom regarded Amun as the prime deity of the city of Thebes in favour of Montu. When the New Kingdom emerged out of Thebes, Amun's status as an important deity became a national thing. However, at some point during Amenhotep IV's reign, he decided that things needed to change. He and his wife
Nefertiti, the heads of Egypt at a time of great wealth and power, decided to alter the religious position of the country. Amenhotep IV is believed to have despised the power that the Church of Amun had in Egypt, and he outlawed the worship of Amun and any other deity other than his own chosen deity, Aten, the sun disk. This was utterly radical. Not only did Amenhotep IV introduce Atenism as the kingdom's religion, but due to his outlawing of other worship, Atenism changed Egypt from polytheistic to monotheistic, something that apparently happened to the Jewish people many hundreds of years later in respect of their deity Yahweh. Amenhotep IV changed his own name to Akhenaten, which translates to effective for Aten. And he would move Egypt's capital city to Amarna, a city that he designed and built for the worship of Aten. Excavations from Amarna, which exists as an archaeological site in the Minya Governorate of modern Egypt, suggest that Akhenaten did not wake up one morning and completely overhaul the entire religious attitude of Egypt. Due to the fact that many artifacts relating to Egypt's other deities have been discovered there from this period, it suggests that Akhenaten probably tried to gradually impose his will over the people of Egypt. The people of Egypt were really not ready to break away from hundreds of years of religious tradition and belief, and this only served to strain the relationship between the people and their pharaoh. Akhenaten would have a son who would also receive a name relating to the sun disk deity Aten. His name was Tutankhaten, which translates as the living image of Aten. After Akhenaten's lifetime, the Amarna period, which represented his will to change the religion of Egypt, came to an end. Akhenaten would come to be regarded as a heretic, even by his own son Tutankhaten, who would allow the religion of Egypt to return to its original condition and subsequently change his own name to honour the Theban god Amun, and therefore he would come to be known as Tutankhamun.
Our second trip back will be once again to ancient Egypt, and this time a little bit further forward. We talk about Ramesses II and when he was crowned the Pharaoh of Egypt. It's a great moment in terms of the history of ancient Egypt. Ramesses II is commonly known as Ramesses the Great, and he ascended to the throne of Egypt around 1279 BCE. He became the third ruler of the 19th dynasty during the New Kingdom period, and along with Thutmose III of the 18th dynasty, Ramesses II is often regarded as one of the greatest, most celebrated and most powerful pharaohs in ancient Egyptian history.
Seti I would have been a young man when Ramesses II was born, so when Seti I died in around the year 1279 BCE, it would have undoubtedly have been a major shock for everybody. Seti's mummified remains showed no signs of physical violence to suggest death during battle. He may have died of a heart attack or something similar, but he was certainly around the age of 40, which was relatively young for a man of such high standing. Ramesses would have been a young man, now in his 20s. So although his father's death may have been unexpected, Ramesses would have been well prepared by those around him throughout his life. One of his first royal duties would have been to travel to Thebes to officiate his father's funeral ceremony at the Theban necropolis. The funeral temple complex of Seti I is a considerable construction, and this is typical of the grand construction projects of this particular Egyptian age. Ramesses was now Ramesses II, the pharaoh of the Egyptian kingdom, and he would instigate a number of construction projects to stamp his mark on the kingdom. Temples would have been erected at Thebes, Memphis, Karnak, and Abu Simbel. However, despite all of the attempts by Ramesses to leave a lasting legacy and honour the deities of the land still had to be protected and provided for. So military defence and offence were both vitally important as soon as Ramesses became the pharaoh. The construction projects would initially have to wait. Firstly, it appears that the Mediterranean coast of Egypt was being subjected to raids. The raids were being conducted by seafarers, which meant that defending the land bridge to Asia, namely the Sinai Peninsula, was not enough. Considerable warriors were attacking from the sea, and we see them being referred to historically as the Sherdan people. Ramesses II certainly knew of the Sherdan people and knew that they were a force to be taken seriously. These people were very well equipped and very dangerous, and Egypt needed a good strong leader to deal with the issue. Not only did Ramesses II deal with the problem, but he also managed to coerce some of the Sherdan warriors to become part of his own army. And this is depicted in stele relating to Asiatic campaigns. Many historians refer to these as among the first known sea peoples, but this is too early to be associating them with the Late Bronze Age collapse, which would not be a major issue until 100 years later. Ramesses II would turn his attention towards the lands of the Levant and the main rival for land and resource, the Hittites. Ramesses would launch a number of campaigns into Canaanite lands during the 1270s. Remarkably, the Sherdan seafarers who joined Ramesses' Egyptian army were actually described by Ramesses himself as originally being allied to the Hittites. His own father, Seti I, had taken the city of Kadesh after the Hittites, under Sipiluliuma I, had taken advantage of the civil crisis in Egypt during the Yamana period of the 14th century BCE. After Seti I's death, the Hittites under Muwatalli II had moved in to take the city back. Ramesses II was not going to let this go, and in 1274 BCE he launched his biggest campaign yet from a modern military centre constructed near the old Hyksos capital at Avaris. 20,000 men left the base with Ramesses himself leading them. This leads us to the Battle of Kadesh, which is a very significant ancient battle, and as such we intend to devote next week's entire podcast episode to the battle itself. So we're not going to cover this battle in detail this week, purely because we intend to focus on the lifetime of Ramesses II and his life. What we will say is that the battle was a considerable battle of wits and tactics between two great armies. The Hittites had the upper hand before a retaliation by the Egyptians caused the Hittites to flee. Upon chasing the Hittites away, the Egyptians had put their remaining units in a vulnerable position, and they then too had to retreat. So the result of the battle was a bit of a stalemate. Ramesses had settled for the decision to put the Hittite city of Kadesh under siege, but this proved to be an inconclusive action, as Ramesses decided to head back to Egypt, safe in the knowledge that things could have turned out to be a lot worse, but that the Hittites now had first-hand experience of what it was like to be in the heat of battle with the Egyptians and would not underestimate their abilities next time. So it could be even translated as a bit of a moral victory for Ramesses, all things considered.
Our next journey back into history and clips from the History of the History of the World podcast also takes us back to ancient Egypt, but this time a biblical story. And it's the story of Moses leading the Jews from Egypt. Now, Moses led the Jews from slavery, and the story of how he did this, how he led the Jews from slavery in Egypt, is a significant event in both Jewish and biblical history. Over 1,000 years after Abraham, the Jews were living as slaves in Egypt. Their leader was a prophet called Moses. Moses led the Jews out of slavery in Egypt and guided them towards the Holy Land that God had promised them. Moses played a pivotal role in leading the Jews away from slavery in Egypt, and his story continues to inspire different people across different religious traditions. The earliest of the three Abrahamic religions was Judaism. Beyond the book of Genesis, we can see the lifetime of Moses as the first time that we hear from the God called Yahweh in the second book of the Tanakh called Exodus. Two things worth mentioning here are the fact that Genesis and Exodus are the names from the Christian Bible, and that the Hebrew names for these books are Bereshit and Shemot. The other thing is that Moses is the one individual mentioned more times than any other in the Quran as a revered prophet who was sent to Egypt by Allah, with Allah being the Arabic word for God. Many Muslims consider Moses' life to have spiritual links to the life of the Prophet Muhammad, who founded their own religion during the first millennium. Often we look at things from a religious and a historian's point of view, and there can be a strong desire to try to find common links between the two things in order for both sides to offer credibility to each other, in a world where this desire hasn't always been the case. The case can also be said for separate religions too, from those who have a desire to demonstrate religious tolerance in these religions, which all too often in history have shown great religious intolerance. So where Judaism, Christianity and Islam all have a recognition of Moses being linked to the Israelites in Egypt and of him having important significance, being chosen for greatness by God, historians have also specifically looked for tangible evidence that the Israelites were in Egypt. And although the evidence has been scant, there is still a strong desire to discover the link. So historians generally do not work against religious scripts and religious sects, but do look for links to validate particular elements of religious scriptures, which are all undoubtedly founded on something. The Jewish story of Moses tells us of how he had led an exodus of Jewish slaves from Egypt. While making this daring and dangerous escape, God appeared before him and delivered a covenant, similarly in nature to Abraham's vision. God famously issued Moses with the Ten Commandments, which set out the boundaries of a peaceful society. The agreement was that Moses would dictate these commandments to the emancipated Jews, and that in return God would protect them in their promised land in Israel, called the Promised Land, as it had been promised to Abraham many generations before. And staying with biblical stories, we're going to go back now and talk about when David became the king of Israel. And the story of David becoming the king of Israel is a significant event in biblical history. David, originally a shepherd boy, gained prominence when he defeated the giant warrior Goliath with a sling and a stone. His bravery caught the attention of King Saul, who appointed him as a commander in his army. After Saul's death in battle, the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron. They acknowledged him as their own flesh and blood and recognized his leadership during military campaigns. The elders of Israel anointed David as king over Israel. David's anointing as king of Israel, marked a turning point in biblical history, and his reign left an indelible mark on the nation.
According to the Hebrew Bible, God favoured the young Israelite called David, who was a humble shepherd with a reputation for fighting off wild animals in the duty of protecting his flock. During the war with the Philistines, the mightiest Philistine warrior, called Goliath, would call out the strongest Israelite to meet him on the battlefield. Goliath was so huge that he struck fear into the hearts of the Israelites. But when David overheard Goliath's challenge, despite not being an Israelite soldier, he asked King Saul to let him face Goliath, believing that God was with him. Saul obliged, and David met Goliath on the battlefield. This legendary battle between the mightiest mountain of a man, the Philistine Goliath, and the humble young Israelite shepherd, David, echoes down to modern day. With the shot of a sling, David defeated Goliath, winning the Israelites the unlikeliest victory over the Philistines in the most legendary underdog victory. David's popularity within Israel would soar, and Saul would realise how out of favour he had become by comparison to David. When David ultimately became the king of the Israelites, he would take Jerusalem from the Jebusites, who occupied it. He would then go on to rule Israel for 40 years before being replaced by his son, Solomon.
And that actually leads us on nicely to our final clip of this magazine, which talks about Solomon building a temple. The construction of the Temple of Solomon, also known as the First Temple, is also a significant event in biblical history. King Solomon, the son of King David, ruled over ancient Israel during the 10th century BCE. Solomon was renowned for his wisdom, wealth, and architectural achievements. Solomon's most significant project was the construction of the Temple in Jerusalem. The temple was intended as a permanent dwelling place for the Ark of the Covenant and a central place of worship for the Israelites. Solomon's construction of the temple was a monumental achievement, symbolizing the spiritual connection between God and his people in Israel.
King Solomon would be the last king of the united monarchy of Israel, as the country would be split into two after Solomon's death. The kingdom of Israel would emerge from the north, while the kingdom of Judah would emerge from the south. Jerusalem would become the capital city of the kingdom of Judah, and a temple dedicated to Solomon was completed in 953 BCE at Mount Zion, in the capital city itself. The temple's deity was Yahweh, and such was its beauty that many would travel great distances to see it. The Ark of the Covenant, containing stone tablets of the Ten Commandments, would find a permanent home here. Those Hebrew men of the lands of Israel were encouraged to make regular pilgrimages to the temple to affirm their worship of Yahweh, the true God. Any worship taking place at other temples and shrines would be considered to be idolatry. Idolatry is the worship of idols or false gods. In another sense, it is the worship of anyone other than Yahweh, the Almighty God of the lands of Israel. It is this version of monotheism that led to the birth of the great monotheistic faiths of the modern world, namely Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, otherwise known as the Abrahamic religions. After Solomon's death, the kingdom of Israel would split.
Thanks Thank you very much for listening to this week's History of the World podcast magazine episode. And if you enjoy the podcast and you want to support the podcast, please visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com. Click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. There you will become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you'll qualify for gifts and rewards. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. Also, you can follow the podcast on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads, and Mastodon. If you can't get enough of the podcast, then look out for the special debrief episodes where I'll be talking some more about the episodes, the main episodes. And that will come next time this weekend, which will be when we finish our story about the Mongols. So part two of the Mongols. We started the story of the Mongols before the episodes about Chinggis Khan and the Battle of Chengdu, which leads us nicely into the period of time after the death of Chinggis Khan and what happened to the Mongol Empire, how it expanded and how it disappeared, which will be coming this weekend.
Listener messages and reviews.
A couple of really nice reviews to read out this week. Saintly Lawyer from Great Britain. I've got a feeling I've mentioned this gentleman before. Has put the best history podcast. Like many before me have said, Chris's podcast is a wonderful account of the history and prehistory of our world. Episodes are super informative, thoroughly researched and well presented. And it's truly a joy to listen to this show on my long journeys to work. I particularly like the section voiceovers to introduce new topics and how Chris refers back to previous episodes where we may have once briefly mentioned a person or city. I emailed Chris and he replied back and was just as warm and friendly as he comes across on his podcast. In fact, it was only through his podcast that I came to know about the significance of Piltdown, which is only a few miles from me. Don't hesitate to start this podcast. Your future self will thank you immensely. Thanks for all you do, Chris, from Saga. Thank you very much. Thank you. Very kind, warm review. The next one I've got is from Pat Roth from the United States of America, who's put, love your show, been listening to the podcast a while now and I'm hooked. Currently on the Peloponnese episodes and it feels like things are starting to accelerate. Your humble dedication to this project is an inspiration. I also needed a soothing podcast to listen to when I got my first hemorrhoid, and this hits the spot. Thanks, Chris. I'm so sorry to hear about your hemorrhoid. What a not fun thing to happen. But I'm glad I've been able to ease the pain. So thank you so much for that wonderful review. There was also, and now I've just got to look this up. I did read something quite interesting from somebody else. I think it was through WordPress. Somebody made a comment about episode 70. I'm just trying to see who wrote it. I'm not sure I've got the username, but nonetheless, it just says, appreciate your ability to pronounce the Mandarin names with quite accurate tones. That's wonderful. I'm so pleased that somebody said that. On another note, I think calling ancient states as nation states is anachronistic before the rise of modern nation states following the French Revolution. Well, that is an interesting point and something I'd be very interested to find out what you all think of. So just drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And what do you think about that point? Should I be referring to medieval countries as nation states? I mean, personally, I think you can. But also the temptation is not to, because there's a real definition of modern nation states. So we talk about modern nation states. And I think in that very review there, it was something you said, the rise of modern nation states. But of course, when I look at a country like Japan, medieval Japan, when I look at medieval England, even medieval France, for me, I would describe them as nation states, countries where people have a cultural similarity and speak one language primarily, where modern nation states are much more organized and politically organized, aren't they? So is a nation state appropriate in the medieval age? I'd be interested in your thoughts. I think there's an argument for and against it, but a very interesting point. So, and I love when people do make challenging points, because it invokes a great discussion. So I'm very interested to hear what you think. So drop me a line at historyoftheworld@mail.com and I'll read your opinions out on a future episode. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thank you so much. Don't forget to tune in this weekend. We'll be talking a lot more about the Mongols and finding out how the story of the Mongols plays out. So it'll be a fascinating episode, crammed full of information, and it'll be a bit of a whirlwind ride. So buckle up for that one, I'd say. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and until next time, be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.